Thank you very much for that introduction, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the organisers, and I'm going to come from a slightly different angle. I'm going to talk about the role that physiologists have to play in both the mitigation and adaptation to climate change. As you've heard, I'm from the Physiological Society in the Extreme Environments Laboratory at the University of Portsmouth, which is becoming much more of an everyday event, the extreme environments bit. And just to support that, there's hardly a day goes by now where you won't see a headline of some record-breaking amount of bushfire, flooding, or temperature. And I suspect we're moving towards that for the UK next week. And it's going to get worse, as Chris has mentioned. And I still find it quite amazing that when people read this, it doesn't evoke an enormous response. It just almost is largely accepted by the general public or ignored and others. And I think there's probably a rate effect in that, in terms of it's still seen as something that's going to happen in the future, as opposed to more immediate problems in terms of things like the energy crisis. But it's going to impact. It's going to impact on definitely on biology, as you've heard, both animal, vegetable, and human in particular. But it's also, that's not going to be the only cost. There's going to be a cost in terms of tidying up after these events. And, you know, it's easy to come up with big numbers, but it's probably worth mentioning that it's about £1.5 billion worth of damage for each of the 10 extreme events that occurred in 2021. And the cost in terms of health costs for malaria, diarrhea, malnutrition, and heat going forward is estimated to be between £2 to £4 billion per year by 2030. Okay, so that kind of supports what Chris was saying. What can we do about it? Well, the Physiological Society is active in this area, as I think I'd like to see all learned societies be. We have a climate change hub, which I encourage you to go and see. We released fairly recently the Physiological and Climate Change Report, which I'll come back to in a moment. We've been working alongside the Wellcome Trust to try and focus some of their calls for work in the area of climate change, which are ongoing. There's this evening's event, and then there's a World Health Summit session in October in 2022, later this year. if we go to look at some of the content of that report, if somebody wants to download it, it's freely available. Heat exposure for workforces and other under-researched groups. We're going to be asking people to work in more extreme conditions. That relates to a decrease in productivity. We've been doing work, for example, in the thermoregulatory responses of flood rescuers. The 1-in-100-year flood is now coming every 2 or 3 years. And we're finding predictions of people getting to heat stroke in about 45 minutes trying to do flood rescues in the warm conditions in which they can occur. Deteriorating air quality. There's a 54% increase in deaths associated with heat exposure with high ozone levels. Flood and drowning risk. When the air temperature gets over about 30 degrees Celsius, there's a close to 70% increase in the number of drownings. Completely counterintuitive, but it's because people choose to leap into cold water to cool off. And particularly at this time of year, the water's still plenty cold enough to induce all the physiological responses that result in drowning. Food safety, we've mentioned, animal conservation, biodiversity, mental health and well-being. So they're all touched on in that report. And then for tonight's event, there is a report which I'm sure you've got your hands on, which is there, which goes through some of the areas. Now, when I came this evening, I had 10 minutes. I've now got 15, which is why I'm going to give you a few anecdotes and speak more slowly than I normally do. But no, let's go and have a little drill down into something. So here are the challenges that you've heard about: increased average temperatures, extreme weather events, and pollution and disease. And on the response side of this particular slide are all the different areas where physiology and physiologists are getting involved in order to try and improve the situation. With the priority on mitigation, we have to do that as opposed to adaptation. Acclimatization, for example. In high-income countries, we have lost our thermal resilience. We spent 90% of our lives living indoors, and we use about 30% of our primary energy sources to keep that indoor environment comfortable in terms of ventilating it, heating it, air conditioning it. I've been asked quite a lot of times this week in the media, why is it that, you know, other countries, middle and low-income countries, have people that can do much better in the kind of conditions that we're experiencing now? And the answer is twofold. Firstly, it's it's behavioural adaptation. People know what to do when. They change their lifestyle. And secondly, they are much more thermally resilient. We've become thermostatic. We don't experience and we don't get to tolerate or acclimatise to changes in the thermal environment. And that's causing problems. So just going one level lower, and I've chosen, unsurprisingly, heat waves to talk a little bit more about. You can go through all of the problems associated with being exposed to the heat. They're on the heat-related problem column on the left here, increased cardiovascular strain, clot formation, particularly vulnerable populations of the elderly. Once air temperature gets above about 26 degrees Celsius, we start to see an incline in the number of heat-related deaths, heat waves producing around about 700 or 800 and deaths in mostly the elderly over 65, over 70 age group, children also being vulnerable because they heat up quickly. So we know the mechanisms of that particular and those particular problems, a combination of cardiovascular stress compounded by dehydration and in heat stroke situations, multi-organ failure caused by, amongst other things, a leaky gut and multi-organ failure, as I say. And we know the neurophysiological and function and vascular physiology associated with these problems. More information is required. We know relatively little, for example, about chronic exposure to specific populations, such as children, elderly, pregnant women, the disabled, and people with comorbidities. So we still have lots to learn in order to give appropriate advice. I've circled manipulate the thermal environment because it leads on from what I was just saying, and it gives you some idea of the winds that you can get. We understand what makes you feel the way you feel about a thermal environment. We know the afferents, we know the peripheral receptor functions. Nobel Prizes have been awarded for these things. And we know how that's integrated, and we know that how that evokes thermoregulatory responses, and we know how it evokes your sensations of thermal comfort and heat and cold. And we also know how they relate to the environment you're in terms of the radiant heat load, air movement, absolute temperature, humidity. And it is possible to manipulate those in a way where you minimize energy costs and still retain comfort. So the mitigation aspect of understanding how the body works, which is physiology, of course, is a reduced dependence on energy-consuming technology and improved thermal comfort, or at least maintained thermal comfort, in warm and cold environments. So this is some work from Professor Jay's lab in Sydney, and obviously Australia have been going through all kinds of almost biblical experiences with flooding and fires. And we know that if you increase the air velocity across the skin, you also increase the thermal comfort threshold by about 3 or 4 degrees, depending on how fast the air goes across the surface of the skin. Now, by increasing that, you're deferring when somebody will go and switch on an air conditioning unit. And so you can see with no fan, the greenhouse gas emissions due to the use of air conditioning is around about 5,000 kilotons. Once you get air moving across the surface of the skin or the surface of the body, you're now offsetting, increasing that thermal comfort threshold to the point where you're using the air conditioning less, and now you're down at around about 1,000 greenhouse gas emissions in terms of compensation. Here's some work from Hui Zhang out in Berkeley. This is looking at the set point temperatures in different US states and US cities. And just look at the set points there. I don't know if this pointer will work. Let's have a look. The set point here, around about the set, if you just change the set point of the thermostat from 24 to 25 degrees Celsius, you've got a 7 to 15% saving in energy use. With heating going from 21.5 to 20.5, so reducing the amount of heating, a 3 to 13%, just changing the airflow from 30% minimum airflow to 20%, 17% or 27% going 10%. There are things you can do that will have a significant knock-on impact in terms of energy consumption and greenhouse gas emissions. All based on, of course, an understanding of how the body works, physiology. And the same information can be used then in helping in the design of the herbal environment. What's going to be acceptable to individuals? What's going to make them retain their levels of comfort and their ability to accept an environment? And that's going to involve working and collaboration with a whole range of individuals. And it may well be we need to have botanists, physiologists, medics, architects, a whole range of different skills coming together to create cooler urban spaces. One of the problems and one of the reasons why, of course, you see more deaths during heat waves in urban environments is because they don't cool down overnight. That island effect, that thermal heat island effect, which means they stay high, so people have deteriorating sleep, and that has knock-on effects for their health. We've heard from Chris about making sure that we have things like active travel and also sustainable eating. And I'll just mention that because we'll go then away from just temperature regulation. We know food production is 20 to 30% of UK's greenhouse gas emissions. 60% of dietary-induced carbon footprint is from meat. And obviously, there are, around the globe, there are large swathes of forest being destroyed in order to create grazing. What physiologists and nutritionists are doing working in this area, trying to get plant-based protein-rich foods that are more sustainable. But you have to make sure that those plant-based substitutes provide the same essential acids, amino acids and leucine, etc., that will help people maintain their health. So developing sustainable proteins that meet nutritional requirements to reduce methane emissions. Another area of understanding, again, how the body works. So the policy priorities is using our understanding of physiology and the consequence of that disturbance to physiology in different aspects of climate change is the first step in attempting to mitigate and adapt to climate change, with the emphasis being on mitigation. As with many other societal challenges, understanding how the body works and goes wrong is critical for optimizing the response to climate change. A multidisciplinary approach and suitable funding models that allow you get money to put a botanist with an architect, with a physiologist, with a medic, will be required to address the health challenges of climate change going forward. And policymakers in the UK should be making decisions to keep people in the UK safe, that's immediate policy action, as well as supporting countries elsewhere through research and funding. I'm delighted to learn that the Wellcome Trust are doing exactly that by funding PIs in other countries, middle and low income countries. And in terms of immediate policy action, the Physiological Society called this week for us to name and rank heat waves. We do that with storms, and heat waves kill a lot more people. And there's plenty of evidence from the LSE, Oxford, various other universities around the globe that actually naming and ranking a heat wave improves focus, improves coordination in terms of the response to the heat wave, is very good in terms of public awareness and public understanding, and promotes behavioral modification. And the one thing that's going to make the difference in the short term before we get to altering the way we design places and the way we design the urban environment is to get people to change the way they behave. They may have to become more Mediterranean. They may have to have a siesta. Who knows? Thank you very much. Thank you.